Imagine a medicine that can just switch off severe heroin withdrawal overnight.
Right.
You take it once, you go through this grueling multi-day experience, and you wake up with the physical cravings for opioids. Just what? Just gone.
Yeah, completely gone.
But now imagine that exact same medicine can also instantly, unpredictably stop your heart. Welcome to the deep dive. Today, we are looking at something that completely shatters your expectations of what a medical breakthrough actually looks like.
It really does.
We're basing today's discussion on a really comprehensive neuroscience article from the OOTW Journal. And our mission today is to unpack the ultimate pharmacological double-edged sword, which is a root bark alkaloid from West Africa called ibogaine. We want to figure out exactly what is happening in the brain and the body when you take it.
And it truly is the ultimate paradox in modern pharmacology. I mean, we spend so much time searching for these clean, targeted cures.
Yeah, the magic bullets.
Exactly. But ibogaine forces us to confront this really uncomfortable reality of promise and peril. It really encourages you to think critically about how we weigh the immediate medical risk, like a literal fatal arrhythmia, against the slow, agonizing devastation of addiction.
Okay, let's unpack this. Imagine you have this delicate antique pocket watch, right? And it's been dropped.
Okay.
The gears are totally jammed, the timing is way off. Using ibogaine to fix an addicted brain is, well, it's a lot like taking a massive neurochemical sledgehammer to that watch. You swing it, you smash the casing, but somehow, miraculously, the impact perfectly resets the gears inside.
That is remarkably accurate, if a slightly terrifying way to picture it.
Right.
Yeah, and to understand how we even found this chemical sledgehammer, you have to trace its bizarre historical journey. I mean, from an African forest all the way to a New York apartment.
So this all starts with the Tabernanthia aeruga shrub, which grows natively in Gabon.
Right, in Central Africa.
Yeah. And for generations, the root bark of this plant hasn't been a medicine in the clinical Western sense. It's a sacrament.
A very intense sacrament.
Exactly. It's the absolute center of the Bouddhist religion, and their initiation rituals are not some gentle sit cross-legged on a cushion meditation. It is a grueling ordeal.
Intensely physical. We're talking about violent, prolonged vomiting.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, complete loss of motor control, profound ataxia. And all of this physical purging eventually leads into an intense waking dream state that can literally last for days.
And the Bouddha use this ordeal intentionally, right? Like the physical toll isn't a side effect for them.
No, it is the point. They believe this overwhelming sensory overload allows the initiate to commune with their ancestors and basically reset their spiritual path.
Which makes the Western translation of this plant so incredibly weird to me.
Oh, it's wild.
Western pharmacology first isolates the active compound, ibogaine, way back in 1901. And they look at this intense, visionary root bark and decide, let's sell it as a pick-me-up.
Right, from the 1930s all the way to the 1960s.
Yeah, a low-dose extract was actually sold in French pharmacies under the brand name Lambaren.
It's just one of the strangest chapters in pharmaceutical history. They marketed it as a stimulant and a neuromuscular tonic.
For athletes, right?
Exactly. It was highly popular with rowers, cyclists, people just looking for an edge against fatigue.
That's so crazy.
I know. But they were taking tiny subperceptual amounts, just a few milligrams. So at that dosage, they were completely disconnected from the plant's hallucinogenic
Or
properties.
its cultural origins, for that matter.
Yeah, to them, it was just a pill to push through a tough workout.
But the real turning point, the moment that changes the history of this drug forever, was a total unexpected
The
accident.
1962 story.
Right, so it's 1962. There's this 19-year-old guy in New York named Howard Lotsoff, and he is struggling with a severe heroin addiction.
Really heavy addiction.
Yeah, and he's part of the underground scene, gets his hands on some ibogaine, he takes it, fully expecting just a fun recreational psychedelic trip with his friends.
Right, just another weekend.
Exactly. Instead, he goes through the absolute gauntlet, the grueling, terrifying ordeal. But when he finally wakes up, like 36 hours later, he steps out into the streets of New York and realizes his opioid cravings are completely gone.
And that just reduced. Completely gone. What's fascinating here is that he wasn't experiencing the bone-deep aches or the nausea or the panic of
That's
withdrawal.
just total reset.
Yeah. And that single anecdotal accident completely shifted ibogaine's trajectory. I mean, from a federally banned Schedule I substance in 1970.
Right, banned alongside LSD and heroin.
Exactly, because the government cited high abuse potential. But despite that, Lotsoff spends the next few decades crusading for it. By the 80s and 90s, he actually secures U.S. patents for using ibogaine to interrupt chemical dependence.
And not just for opioids, right? He patents it for cocaine, alcohol, even nicotine.
Yeah, a highly sought-after target. But historical anecdotes only take us so far. The real question is mechanism. How does a recreational trip accidentally cure a heroin addiction?
Right, because that makes no sense on the surface.
Exactly. To answer that, we have to look at how incredibly messy this molecule is.
So when we usually talk about drugs that cause hallucinations, things like classic psychedelics, LSD, or psilocybin, we're talking about clean drugs, right?
Right, what pharmacologists call clean.
Yeah.
Like a specific key fitting into a specific lock.
Targeting just one serotonin receptor, mostly, the 5-HT2A receptor. But ibogaine doesn't play by those rules at all.
Not even a little. Ibogaine is a textbook dirty drug. It doesn't just hit one receptor. It binds to a half dozen completely unrelated neurological systems all at once.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, and it does so with low micromolar affinity, which, you know, out of lab speak, just means the drug has an absolute hair trigger. It takes a tiny concentration to jam those receptors wide open.
Wait, so instead of a sniper rifle carefully targeting one specific symptom, this is basically a biochemical shotgun blast going off inside your nervous system.
That's exactly what it is. It hits the NMDA channel, which is heavily involved in memory and learning. That's actually similar to how ketamine works.
Right. Resetting depressive circuits.
Yeah. And it also acts as an agonist at the kappa opioid receptor. Scientists think this specific interaction causes that intense dysphoric dream state that the booty utilize.
And it does even more than that, doesn't it?
Oh, yeah. On top of that, it's a potent blocker of the alpha-3 beta-4 nicotinic receptor, which modulates reward pathways. It's flipping all these massive switches simultaneously.
Wait a second, though. I have a mechanical pushback here.
Okay, let's hear it.
Even if it is hitting all these switches, the pharmacokinetic data shows that ibogaine flushes out of the human body incredibly fast, like a terminal half-life of only 2 to 8 hours.
Right, it's gone quickly.
So if you take it in the morning, it's mostly cleared out by dinner time. How in the world can a drug that disappears that quickly suppress brutal opioid cravings for weeks or months? The math just doesn't add up.
That is the exact right question to ask. And it leads us to the crucial plot twist here. The secret isn't actually ibogaine itself. It's what your body turns it into.
Okay, the metabolite secret.
Exactly. When you ingest ibogaine, it hits your liver. And your liver employs a specific enzyme called CYP2D6.
Sounds catchy.
Right. Well, think of this enzyme like a pair of biological molecular scissors. It comes along and snips a single methyl group off the ibogaine molecule. And when it does that, it transforms it into a highly active metabolite called norbogaine.
And let me guess, norbogaine behaves completely differently than its parent.
It's almost like an entirely different drug. What? It's a much more potent serotonin reuptake inhibitor, and it engages the opioid system differently. It actually behaves in a way that helps substitute for the missing heroin without causing a high.
Oh, interesting.
But the most vital difference is time. While ibogaine clears in a few hours, norbogaine is incredibly sticky. It lingers in the blood for a day, sometimes 2 full days.
Oh, wow. So the ibogaine is really just the delivery mechanism, like the shock and awe up front.
Right.
But the norbogaine is the biological anchor doing the heavy lifting in the background to keep the withdrawal at bay.
Precisely. But here is the terrifying catch to this mechanism. You know that genetic roulette we sometimes see with medications?
Yeah.
Well, humans have wildly different genetics when it comes to producing that CYP2D6 enzyme. Some people are what pharmacologists call poor metabolizers. Their liver just doesn't produce enough of those molecular scissors.
So if you're a poor metabolizer, you don't get the protective norbogaine. You just suffer through the withdrawal.
It's actually much more dangerous than that. Yes, you don't make the norbogaine efficiently. But because you can't process it, you also don't clear the original ibogaine fast enough.
Oh, no. So it just builds up.
Exactly. Backs up in your system.
Yeah.
Your total drug exposure can actually double compared to a normal metabolizer. This makes a standard dose dangerously unpredictable.
So what might be a perfect healing dose for you could be a massive overdose for someone else in the exact same room.
Exactly. It's highly personalized medicine, but in a completely hidden and very dangerous way.
That is wild. Okay, so having the sticky metabolite lingering in your system explains the immediate relief, but it still doesn't explain the long-term abstinence, right? People report staying off drugs for months.
Right, and for that, we have to look past the blood plasma. We have to dig directly into the physical structure of the brain itself.
Specifically, the brain's reward center, the ventral tegmental area, or the VTA.
Yes, there's a landmark neuroscience study from Dorit Rahn's laboratory that really cracked this open.
Mm-hmm.
They took rats that had been trained to consume high levels of ethanol.
Basically addicted rats.
Yeah. And they injected ibogaine directly into the VTA of these rats.
Yeah.
And as expected, it successfully reduced their drinking.
Here's where it gets really interesting, though. The how is the fascinating part. It didn't just make the rats sick or sleepy. It fundamentally changed their neurobiology.
Yes, a physical change.
The ibogaine causes the brain to dramatically upregulate this protein called GDNF, which stands for glial cell line-derived neurotrophic factor. It pushes it through this biochemical domino effect, the Reeder K12 pathway.
Which is a mouthful.
Yeah, but you can just picture it as a cascade of signals that physically regenerates damaged neurons.
That is the perfect way to describe it. And what makes Dorit Rahn's study so brilliant is how they closed the causal loop.
Right, proving it wasn't just a coincidence.
Exactly. They neutralized the GDNF in the rats' brains. They blocked it. And when they did, the anti-addictive effect of the ibogaine completely vanished. The rats went right back to chain drinking ethanol.
That proves the drug absolutely needs that protein to work.
Right. But then they tried the reverse, which is even crazier. They took away the ibogaine entirely. No drug. And they just directly injected pure GDNF protein into the reward center.
And the anti-addictive effect happened anyway. The rats stopped drinking without ever taking the hallucinogen.
Yes, exactly.
It's like GDNF is Miracle-Gro for your reward circuitry. It repairs the barren earth that years of addiction left behind. I mean, think about the implications of that for a second.
It's huge.
We focus so much on the crazy multi-day spiritual journey. But what if the true healing power isn't the subjective psychedelic experience at all? What if it's just this quiet, structural neuroplasticity happening in the background?
It completely reframes how we view psychedelic medicine. We often assume the breakthrough happens because of a profound spiritual epiphany. But this research suggests the mechanism might be purely structural, a literal rewiring of broken circuits.
Which sounds exactly like the holy grail of addiction treatment. So if this is literal Miracle-Gro for a brain ravaged by addiction, why isn't it available in every major hospital right now?
And this is where we have to bring in the calm, sobering, and honestly tragic reality of this molecule. Why we talk about the heart's hard limit.
Because it blocks so many systems.
Right. We mentioned it blocks multiple unrelated systems. Well, one of those is a vital potassium channel in the human heart called the HERG channel.
So if it's blocking a potassium channel, we're talking about the electrical system, the literal pacing of the heartbeat.
Exactly. Think of your heart as having an electrical reset button. Every time it beats, it has to electrically repolarize or reset itself during that tiny pause.
Okay, I follow.
The HERG channel carries the rapid electrical current responsible for that reset. When ibogaine jams that channel shut, it slows down the heart's ability to repolarize. On an ECG, you'd see this as a prolonged QT interval.
The gap between the beats gets stretched out.
Right. And if that interval gets too long, it triggers a terrifying condition called torsades de pointe.
Which is a fatal arrhythmia. The heart essentially loses its rhythm, starts quivering instead of pumping, and just stops.
Yes.
So just how close is the healing dose, the amount we need to trigger that GDNF Miracle-Gro to the deadly dose? Are we talking about a massive margin of error here?
No. The math is terrifying.
Mm-hmm.
It is a razor-thin margin. Ibogaine blocks the HERG channel at around 4 micromolar. And norbogaine is even more potent. It blocks it at just 2.9 micromolar.
Wait, really?
Yes. And those numbers overlap almost exactly with the plasma concentrations needed to actually stop the opioid withdrawal.
Let me make sure I'm getting this. The exact amount of drug you need circulating in your blood to save your brain is the exact same amount that starts blocking your heart's reset button.
Yes. There is absolutely no safe buffer zone. None.
Wow. So if we look at the historical data, investigators did a major forensic review of 19 documented deaths outside of Africa between 1990 and 2008.
Right.
Based on that razor-thin margin, these people didn't overdose in the classic sense. Their brains weren't shutting down their breathing like with fentanyl. Their electrical systems just short-circuited.
You're exactly right. The autopsies are chilling. There was zero brain toxicity.
Mm.
Every single death pointed right back to the heart.
That's horrifying.
It is. Now, context matters. These fatalities were often worsened by pre-existing heart disease or a total lack of medical screening. Sometimes patients secretly co-ingested opioids before the session. But the fatal trigger was always cardiac electrical failure.
It really forces you to acknowledge that this is not some benign, gentle plant medicine. It is a biochemical wrecking ball. So given this undeniable heart-stopping risk, how is anyone safely using this today?
Well, mostly they're doing it in the shadows. Because it remains a Schedule I drug in the U.S., desperate people are traveling to unregulated gray market clinics in places like Mexico or Costa Rica.
And the standard of care for something this dangerous should be incredibly rigorous.
Absolutely. You'd need baseline ECGs, full electrolyte panels, and continuous cardiac monitoring with an ICU-level medical team standing by with a defibrillator.
But in an unregulated setting, that's a massive, dangerous gamble. You don't know if you're getting a critical care team or just an enthusiastic shaman in a living room.
Which brings us to a beacon of highly rigorous recent study. In 2024, a team at Stanford tracked 30 U.S. Special Operations Forces veterans who went to Mexico for treatment.
These were men suffering from severe traumatic brain injury, chronic PTSD, and profound depression, right?
Exactly. They had exhausted every traditional therapy. But the Stanford team monitored them before and after. And crucially, this specific clinic co-administered an intravenous drip of magnesium alongside the ibogaine.
Why magnesium? Does it protect the heart?
Yes. It acts as a structural stabilizer for the heart's electrical gradient. Heavily supplementing it helps to blunt that dangerous QT prolongation effect. It provides a layer of cardiovascular armor.
Well, the chaotic drug does its neuroplastic work in the brain.
Right.
And the results from this veteran cohort are absolutely staggering. 1 month after treatment, they saw an 88% reduction in PTSD symptoms, an 87% reduction in depression.
And an 81% reduction in anxiety.
Yeah. And most importantly, under this specific protocol, there were zero serious adverse cardiac events.
Now, as an analyst, I have to dutifully remind everyone that this was an observational, self-selected, all-male cohort. There was no control group.
So not absolute proof.
Right. Not proof of clinical efficacy, but as a signal. It suggests that, with the exact right medical scaffolding, the lethal risk might actually be manageable.
And what's wild is that public policy is rapidly outpacing clinical trials right now. As of June 2025, the state of Texas signed a bill committing $50 million toward FDA clinical trials for ibogaine.
That is a massive public investment.
Texas is literally wagering $50 million that this highly dangerous compound can somehow be tamed.
It's a profound shift in momentum.
So what does this all mean? We started with a paradox and we end with one. Ibogaine is a complex, chaotic molecule that offers a genuine neurochemically backed off-ramp for severe addiction through GDNF rewiring.
Right, it repairs the hardware.
But it carries an undeniable, lethal cardiac tax.
And I want you to consider how modern science usually handles these dirty drugs. We usually hate chaos. We want a single switch, a clean lock and key.
Yeah, isolate the target and ignore the rest.
Exactly. But ibogaine proves that sometimes the most profound healing requires engaging multiple biological systems simultaneously. It forces us to rethink pharmacology itself.
It really does. And science is currently racing to outsmart this molecule. They are trying to isolate the therapeutic benefits with synthetic analogs like 18-MC.
Right. Trying to remove the HERG cardiac risk entirely.
Exactly. And to remove that intense multi-day psychedelic dream state. But I want to leave you with a final thought to ponder.
Yeah.
If we successfully strip away the deeply profound, challenging spiritual ordeal that the Bawiti people have utilized for centuries, and we reduce it to a simple side effect-free pill, are we genuinely healing the human being, or are we just temporarily resetting a biological machine?